Welcome to Best Bets, the Sandringham Research School podcast. This podcast aims to provide you with the latest education research and insights about how evidence can be used to benefit students in your school. Although education research can never tell us exactly what to do within the classroom, it can provide us with best bets, tried and tested approaches that the evidence suggests may lead to promising outcomes. In each episode, we will draw upon the experience of a researcher or teacher with a particular expertise in the area we are looking at. And a little bit about us. Sandringham is a Hertfordshire secondary school and has been designated as a research school by the EEF. You can follow us on Twitter at SandResearch. I'm Kate Mountsey, one of the research leads at our research school. In this episode, we are talking to Dr. Duncan Astle, a group leader at the MRC Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit at the University of Cambridge. Duncan leads research on a broad programme of development cognitive neuroscience, including understanding neural systems in childhood and how they are linked to development disorder. His research has included a focus on working memory, ADHD, and how memory affects development. We have been very fortunate to hear Duncan speak at some of our CPD programmes, where he has helped teachers to understand the science behind learning and to then think through practice and interventions in the classroom. And we are really pleased that we can now introduce Duncan to a wider audience. Welcome, Duncan. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to be able to hear from you. And perhaps could we start with asking about the focus of your current research at Cambridge?
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to talk to you. Lots of different projects on the go at the minute, but I'm just going to tell you about two. So the first one is looking at a child's environment and how it shapes their cognitive development, their learning over time in school, and their brain development. So we know that a child's environment can have a really massive effect on all of those things, but there's lots of variability. So for example, some children who grow up in very deprived circumstances do really, really well, and others really struggle. And we're really interested in what really drives that variability. So why it is that children respond to the same environment in different ways. And the reason I'm telling you about that project is because we actually studied about 600 children about a year ago. And when the lockdown began in March, it occurred to us that it was a really great opportunity if we could get in touch with those 600 people and find out what life was like during lockdown and see whether there had been any changes. And we were able to get in touch with about 200 of them, and they completed lots of different kind of questionnaires and surveys. And it meant that we could look, for example, at what the impact of a radical change in your environment, so going into lockdown, would have on your mental health. And it's very rare that you're able to do those kinds of things. So that was very exciting. And the second project, sorry, Kate, you can ask me a question about that.
No, I was just thinking how fascinating that was.
Yeah, which, the thing is, of course, everyone is super excited and interested to find out what effect lockdown is having. However, it's really, really difficult to know, because if you don't have baseline data, so data from kids before the lockdown began, then it's really hard to pinpoint down what's the actual effect of the lockdown itself. So we were in quite a rare position, which made it very worthwhile.
Yeah.
Second project, we're still spending a lot of time looking at research into children who struggle to learn. And what we're trying to do at the moment is actually build some models of how their brains develop to see whether, in a kind of mathematical way, we can try and understand what are the different trajectories that children might go down and what might be the factors that influence whether they go down one trajectory or another. So those are sort of two of the projects that we're working really hard on at the moment.
Thank you. They both sound really fascinating. And I know there's an awful lot out there at the moment about how students of any age, whether they're primary up to secondary into university, are responding
to the lockdown situation, both in learning but also in their mental health. So I'll be really interested to follow that and any findings that you have.
Yeah, so our early findings actually show that so the children we've looked at are in late primary, and there are significant increases in symptoms of depression during lockdown. So it'd be interesting to see. There are some larger scale national surveys going on at the minute, but they'll be won't be out for some months yet. And it'll be interesting to see in those much bigger surveys whether they find the same thing.
Yeah. And I know schools are worried about that going forward and how to plan for that in September. Just changing tack slightly, I've heard you speak in the past about memory a lot. And as teachers, we are really concerned about that because it's so involved with actual day-to-day learning. And we've heard a lot about memory and retaining knowledge. Can I ask you, as a scientist, what's the difference between the terms we often hear, working memory and long-term memory?
Gosh, good question. Well, they're very, very different. Both important for learning, but in different ways. So working memory is called memory, but really it's a lot closer to attention or something we call executive function. So it's the ability to hold in mind and manipulate small amounts of information for brief periods of time. It's a bit like the desktop on your computer. It's what you've got open at the moment. It has a really limited capacity. People debate what the actual limit is, but it's limited, and it can easily get overloaded. So that's working memory. Long-term memory is much more durable. It potentially can last a lifetime, and there are separate types of long-term memory. So for example, you may have heard of episodic long-term memory and semantic long-term memory. And so episodic is for memory for events that have happened to you, and semantic is knowledge or facts. And when we learn, information is initially represented in an episodic format, and then gradually over time it can become represented as a semantic memory, which means that it potentially lasts a lifetime. So for example, you know that the Paris is the capital of France. That's a semantic fact that you know, but at some point that was an episodic memory. There was a first time that you found out that Paris was the capital of France, and gradually over time that becomes consolidated and forms a more durable semantic memory, and you kind of lose the original episodic form that it had. And so when we're learning, what we're constantly in the process of doing is making new episodic memories, so new events, a memory formed in a classroom, and then gradually over time what we're hoping to do is allow that to transfer into a more semantic memory that could last a lifetime. So working memory and long-term memory, really very, very different. One is more like an online buffer of information you need right now. The other is more like a kind of long-term file drawer where you're constantly adding in new things and then seeing whether some things form durable memories that could last a lifetime.
Okay. So as teachers, we're very concerned, as you said just then, with helping students to embed that knowledge in their long-term memory. Are there specific learning strategies or things we can do as individuals to help that or to encourage students in that respect?
Well, actually, in the Ofsted guide, the most recent one for schools, there's a really helpful section called the Learning Sciences. And what that's really referring to is exactly the kinds of long-term memory that we were just talking about. So the transition from something that's an episodic memory to being a more durable semantic memory. And they give lots of tips of how you can encourage that. So things like spacing learning out rather than clumping it together. And that means that you have the continual opportunity to revisit material. And we know that each time you revisit it, you increase the chances that it's going to transfer from an episodic memory to a semantic memory. Testing, so using testing as a learning tool rather than just an assessment, has been shown to be a really powerful way of encouraging fragile episodic memories to become durable semantic memories. And there are various other tips in there, things like making sure that individuals get enough sleep, because we know that when people sleep, the information is consolidated from episodic formats into semantic formats. and things like interleaving. So interleaving is where you, let's say you have some math problems, rather than doing all of the problems that require one type of solution together and then all for another type of solution, you interleave them such that the person gets to practice revisiting and recalling the type of solution they need lots of times. And that again can encourage information that's initially in a fragile episodic format to become a really durable semantic memory. And so that section of the Ofsted Guide on Learning Sciences is really helpful actually in highlighting some of those areas.
Okay, thank you. That's really, really powerful. I think as teachers, we've heard of these things and we perhaps need to do a bit more digging on how they work in the classroom. Can you actually increase your working memory as an individual, or is it fixed, or does it fix at a certain age, for example?
Really controversial question. I guess I'll give you what is the current state of the debate. So working memory has a real capacity limit, and that limit varies across individuals. It varies a lot, actually. So, you know, if you're in a classroom, you'll have children who have working memory capacities equivalent to a child 2 or 3 years their senior, as well as children with working memory capacities equivalent to 2 or 3 years their junior. So a massive spread, all in the same class. It rises gradually through primary years and through secondary years. And generally, depending on how you measure it, it's thought to reach adult-like levels probably around somewhere like 15, 16.
Okay.
But those individual differences persist. So some people do have more than others. Now, can it be changed, right? So some people have shown that if you train working memory, then you do get better at working memory tasks, right? So you perform better on working memory tasks, even if they're not the ones that were used in the training. The problem is that no one has ever really convincingly shown that you really increase your working memory capacity in everyday life. Really, you've just got better at learning how to perform the particular tasks. So I think the evidence suggests at the minute that if there are ways of changing your working memory capacity, then we've yet to find them. Mm-hmm. And so interventions that are designed to boost your working memory probably aren't going to work. At least not in the way you hope.
No. And sort of following that theme, then you mentioned there may be some students in your class, or there will be, with, let's say, poorer working memory naturally. What could be the implications for those students?
I think that they will need to be more deliberate in how they learn. And I say that because I think when we are learning in class, we don't often realise how much information we're having to store as we go, you know, instructions, stuff on a page, a diagram you saw, something written on the board. And if you've got a really good working memory capacity, then you probably don't even realize that maintaining all this information is quite effortful. Because if you've not got such a great working memory capacity, you're very aware of that fact, because you lose things along the way. You know, you find yourself slipping off task, you have to look back to the board more often, you can't remember what was in the previous sentence. And so I think those individuals and their teachers will need to be more deliberate in the way that they learn. So breaking things up, using memory aids to help stay on task, trying to make sure that you're only doing one thing at a time rather than trying to do multiple things at once. And some studies have shown that those sorts of strategies and techniques can be much more effective in helping kids with poorer working memory than, say, trying to train their working memory.
Okay, thank you. And sort of linked to that again, does working memory affect specific learning difficulties? Is there a crossover? Could they be confused in some way?
It's interesting. So they're not part of any diagnosis. So they're not, you know, having poor working memory isn't a diagnostic feature of any recognized condition that I am aware of. But it's a really common feature of lots of kids who struggle to learn. Mm-hmm. And so we would sometimes say that it's what we call a transdiagnostic feature, as in, regardless of whether you have a diagnosis or not, or what that diagnosis is, your working memory capacity still seems to be super important for the way that you learn. And so we're actually sort of gradually trying to, I think, move to a place where we're less focused on the diagnosis itself, and more focused on the kinds of skills that we think are proximal to learning, like working memory. So, okay. Yeah, so they're not, so they, of course, they are linked to different types of learning difficulty. But that's not because they're a diagnostic feature of them, but just that they seem to be a common feature of lots of kids who struggle to learn.
Okay, so there's quite a lot we could do there to help, really, with or without a diagnosis.
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, if a child has a difficulty in working memory, chances are they won't have any kind of diagnosis. Whereas if a child has ADHD, for example, has a diagnosis of ADHD, they may well have poor working memory as well. And it may well be the poor working memory that's really the strongest predictor of their learning, not having an ADHD diagnosis.
Okay, so again, changing tack slightly, but as you're a scientist sitting here in front of us, we hear a lot about the brain and how we learn, and there's a lot of tips and hints out there, but are there any myths that we should be aware of so we don't incorrectly apply them in our practice as teachers?
Gosh, there are so many, it's hard to know which one to choose. I'm going to go with learning styles, because I think when I give talks at schools and I run through some myths, some of them are quite comic, like, you know, left hemisphere for logic, right hemisphere for creativity. That's nonsense too, by the way. But the one that seems to shock people is when we cover learning styles. And I think that's because, as an idea, it feels quite intuitively nice that everyone learns in different special ways. And I think it's become so pervasive as an idea. I think there was a massive push on it probably about 10 years ago. And it was really widely promoted, this idea of, you know, some people are kinesthetic learners, some people are visual learners, some people are auditory learners. But the data show that you are no better in your supposed preferred style than in any other. And I think the reason that it's really important to call out that myth is because I think it could actually be quite damaging. And that's because if you tell kids from an early age, oh, you're a kinesthetic learner or you're a visual learner, when you try and present information in some different style, what is the incentive for them to bother paying attention? After all, it's not in their preferred style. And so I think that I realize that the intent behind it is probably very noble, which is to say, you know, different people learn in different ways and there's no right way of learning. And, you know, it's about kind of creatively finding ways to learn best. But it's kind of fallen into this idea of sort of pigeonholing kids into only learning in one particular way. And as a myth, that can be quite dangerous because I think it could really actually steer kids down a particular path for which there isn't really any evidence.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yes, I think that has been around for a long time actually in teaching. So it's quite, again, good to hear it from an actual scientist that maybe that's not the best thing to do.
I mean, it's not to say that it's not good to think of creative ways that the same information can be delivered from different perspectives. Mm. So, you know, we've known for a long time, you know, back to the learning sciences, that if you get something called deep processing, which is where you really kind of get to the underlying meaning of what's being taught by accessing it in different ways, then we know that those memories can become incredibly durable. You get really great learning. So we know that if you kind of attack something from multiple different angles, that's really, really powerful. But that's not the same as kind of pigeonholing kids and saying you only learn in that kind of way.
So there's some uses in different methods, but not, as you say, categorizing one child per method.
Exactly.
Okay, and finally then, are there any resources or authors or things that you think would be easy for teachers to read or that we're interested in this? Is there a go-to place or any tips that we could look for?
Well, as you know, the Education Endowment Foundation is really good on this. So actually, I know that in other countries, they're actually quite jealous that we have something like the Education Endowment Foundation, because they have a really strong emphasis on evidence-based practice, and they will give you a kind of good rating on something about the evidence behind something and the kind of effect that it's likely to have. So, I mean, the evidence might be very strong, but the effect size is tiny, then they will be able to tell you. So on their website, they've got some great resources. I think there's some really great books coming out now on something called neurodiversity, which sounds quite fancy, but it's quite simple, really. It's essentially saying that we've spent a lot of time trying to categorize children, you know, as we've talked about in this podcast, but that actually children are just incredibly diverse and they often don't really meet those categories. Mm. And as, you know, scientists and educators, I think we need to think carefully about how we make sure that those individuals are included, you know. So child with ADHD might be praised for their energy on the sports field and then kind of told off for it in the classroom. And you can see how that kind of can become really confusing. And I think there's a move ahead now underway to try and think more seriously about how we make sure that these kids who are kind of neurodivergent are included in what we do.
Mm, that's really interesting. Thank you. That makes a lot of sense, actually, to me, observing all thousands of children over the years running through this school and others, that they are unique.
Yeah.
And to have these groups and diagnoses is very troublesome. I know that there's some reasons for it.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, right? It's moment of diagnosis can be a really powerful moment for children and families. Problem is, it can also then become kind of all-consuming.
Yeah.
And actually, it can become quite stigmatizing for kids. And, you know, we know that the outcomes for these children are not great over and above learning. You know, they're more likely to be bullied. They're more likely to experience poor mental health, more likely to be excluded from school. And so what is it that we do to try and ensure that those things don't happen?
Mm, yeah. Well, thank you, Duncan. That was so interesting. We really appreciate your time today. And I know listeners will really have enjoyed hearing about your expertise and knowledge in this fascinating and really, really important area. So thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to episode 3 of Best Bets. To follow up on the ideas and strategies mentioned by Duncan in this episode, head over to our website, researchschool.org.uk/Sandringham. If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate us and write a short review if you have time. Ratings and reviews allow others to see the podcast when they're browsing. Do also subscribe to Best Bets and you'll get the next episode automatically through your podcast app.